Hey, everybody, welcome back to another installment of the Verbal Shenanigans Podcast, episode 185. And we have a very athletic episode for you today, and it is fantastic. But I want to talk to you about a couple of the sponsors we have on this show, and we are lucky to work with. Susan Robb, R-O-B-B, is she's a woman we work with. She's one of the sponsors for our program with Kim Ward and Paul Templer, who is a hippo attack survivor. They are launching the Nepal Outreach Program and really need your donations. Their goal is to reach $25,000 through individual and corporate sponsorship. They've already raised over $5,000, and what that's going to is to put 15 kids into school for the year and supply 17 ladies and moms with sewing supplies to start a business to sell these quilts in order to get them housing. They've already sold 10 quilts in over 5 different countries around the world. The Templar Foundation is a not-for-profit 501c3, and their mission is to secure the house for the women and enroll all 17 kids into school the next year. So Kim and Susan, they're tirelessly working to try to get donations. They could really use your help. So please make a donation at their GoFundMe, the Nepal Outreach Program, or look at them at Twitter at Kim Ward, Kim Marie Ward, or at M Susan Robb, R-O-B-B-3. Okay. They're just good. They really help us with the show, get us some really fun guests, and it's just a really excellent cause. Now, we are lucky enough to have two brewery sponsors on the podcast. One of them happens to be Demented Brewing, one of my favorite places to go and to just hang out and have a pint in one of the coolest tasting rooms in New Jersey. They got 16 rotating taps. There's always something different about Demented. What I love about Demented is it's not one style of beer. It's pretty much everything, and they're always kind of pushing limits either way. They just released Sloth, their milk stout on draft in the tasting room, and this Sunday they're going to be releasing their all-new Doppelbock. So you got to check out Demented right in Middlesex, Demented Brewing. Check them out, DementedBrewing.com, Instagram, Facebook, Demented Brewing. Now, Manskirt Brewing is located in Hackettstown, New Jersey, in the old bank building. They're just a really cool hang, too. Big, loose room, 8 rotating seasonally inspired ales. They do a lot of different things also, which is what I like about them. They got Burns Night coming on February 3rd at 5:30. There's a Facebook event. There's haggis, bagpipes, music, poetry, kilts. Kilts are strongly encouraged, hence the old manskirt. If you ever go there, you'll see Joe in his manskirt. It's just a really cool place to hang. Support your local brewery. That is Manskirt Brewing. Now, finally, Trivia Revolution, fueled by craft beer. They are a company I happen to work for on Wednesday nights, but they do trivia all over the state of New Jersey in breweries and beer bars. And you can basically come out and play trivia for free, win prizes, either prizes to restaurants or prizes to breweries to get some craft beer. Just a really fun night, even if you are in last place. So go check out Trivia Revolution, fueled by craft beer. Okay, we got two really cool guests on the show. From the Boston Celtics, the New Jersey Nets. Yes, that's right, the New Jersey Nets. And a whole bunch of other teams. Point guard for many years, Mr. Chibs himself, Kenny Anderson, joined us on the show for a very open interview about some of the things he struggles with and his new business ventures and life after basketball. So a very cool interview. And then Olympian, gold medalist, Canadian curler John Morris, Johnny Moe, joins us on the show and gives us an insight into the world of curling. And he is heading to the Olympics again coming up. So really, really cool show. Some very fun names in different worlds of athletics. So with that, guys, enjoy the podcast.
Hey, what's up? This is Kenny Anderson, and you're listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
Hey, this is Johnny Moe from Canada. I'm curling at the Olympics in South Korea, and you're listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah. I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Hello, Michael.
Hello, Scott.
How are you doing, Michael?
I just finished up a text with somebody, so I guess I'll try to be professional now.
What were you texting about, Michael?
News? Back and forth with a person I used to work with and all laughing at my former boss being a lying sack of something.
But anyway, welcome to another installment of the podcast, episode 185.
Woo.
Got those plans for 200.
Okay, I'll show up and I'll talk in the microphone.
You're supposed to be planning the big surprise party.
Oh.
With mega guest.
Does Joe Carney count as one?
No, no. I was thinking in like the Mick Jagger realm, like if you can arrange something like that.
I guess I can go, "Hey, Mick," on Twitter. That was my original catchphrase.
Hey. Hey, Dollar Tree. But anyway, guys, welcome back to another show. We had a fun one today. Very sports-oriented one tonight. Speaking of sports, the Patriots are invincible yet again.
Scott, that can't be. We said that last year. No, look back at your notes and 4 years from now.
Yep. It's they're just amazing, man.
They're consistent.
You can never count them out. Like,
Lord knows
everybody watching that game knew they were coming back. Like,
yeah.
Everybody. I was down like at the clubhouse down here and I was watching and everyone's like, "Yeah, they're going to come back." Like, "Yeah, that touchdown doesn't matter." Oh, like, you know, like as soon as you put Brady with the ball, it's over.
They just have a plan, and you see every game they have like two flea flickers, a fumble rooski, onside kick, something. It's just like, yep, what the hell? And always catch them off guard.
Yeah, I've over the years, I think we may have talked, but I've become in the minority. Like, I don't even hate the Patriots. They're just like, to me, it's like the chance to watch like Jordan in his prime at this point. It's like hating LeBron James to me. I'm like, I don't like the Cavs, but when they get there, I'm like, this is cool. Like, I'll watch it.
I guess.
It's the greatest, or Tiger in his prime, or, you know, like, it's just, this isn't going to happen again, or at least, you know, for
probably
a long
not.
Time.
Yeah.
Some kind of 20-year stretch of being in the Super Bowl 8 times, you know, like half of his career he's been in the Super Bowl.
That's insane. This was a guy who was drafted as a fourth-string quarterback.
Yep.
They kept him on the roster for a year. They refused to make him on the practice squad, noting somebody would pick him up. They literally just wasted a spot to keep him around. And all it took was, well, it was Drew Bledsoe, some crappy run. He got knocked out by the Jets, and that's it.
And it's just, it's crazy to think that it's not like there's like a supporting cast that's been there the whole time. It's him and Belichick. Everyone else has been swapped in and out, and just different guys all the time.
Gronkowski's been pretty much there for all of them.
He's been there for a while, though.
I mean, I know that their first one, they got it without. First two, actually, I think.
Gronk is like on the second wave of this dynasty, whatever you want to call it, like the recent wave.
But he always gets injured, and now he's got that concussion. Who knows if he'll be back or
he'll
not.
He'll be back. There's no way he's missing the Super Bowl.
You know the Patriots will sneak him answers like to a concussion test or something.
If I'm the other team, that's like my strategy. Like, go head-to-head. Just go blast
just
Gronk in the head.
Just smack somebody, yeah.
Put in like the third string cornerback and be like, just take him out. We'll take the penalty, knock him out of the game, and then
it'll be like the Running Man. They'll be out there with like electrical instruments and stuff like that just to knock out people. It's cool. We'll take the 15-yard penalty. Oh, you third-string defensive tackle, damn you.
Well, I mean, essentially that's what happened yesterday, and they still won. You know, they didn't have Gronk for basically most of the game.
Yeah, before it happened. Yeah, it was in the second quarter.
Yeah, so. Anyway, so I'll be rooting for the Patriots because nothing in my body can root for the Eagles. I can't root for the Eagles, the Flyers, the Phillies. I can't do it.
Yeah,
they're all rivals. It's like I can't root for the Cowboys. If the Cowboys were here, I can never root for them.
I mean, I'm in a torn spot. I mean, I would like it for my sister, but kind of going back to what I was talking about with my boss and all, what made me torn was he's a rabid Eagles fan, and I'm just like, son of a bitch, a guy's happy right now. It's like I can't stand.
I see Eagles fans are right in normal form. I read a couple things today. They're punching horses. Police horses.
That's a famous thing.
Yep. Punching horse. I saw they had banners that said, you know, F Millie, and Millie was that 100-year-old Viking woman.
Viking woman.
Chanting that. So Philly's right, where nothing changes. Nothing changes.
The best part was the day of the game, they were Criscoing the poles to make sure nobody climbed up the light structures, because apparently, like, when the Phillies won, like, they tore down like 12 of them doing that.
Yeah, so if the Eagles win the Super Bowl, there's just not going to be a Philadelphia anymore.
Oh, yeah. If Philadelphia wins the Super Bowl, you don't want your car within 200 miles of that vicinity, because that's a football town. As much as they go nuts for all the other teams, if they win a Super Bowl, that's going to be next level Philadelphia. You think those fans are interesting now, wait till they get a ring.
I picture it like being The Walking Dead after like 2 days. Like people just surviving on their own.
Some guy's in the hospital, wakes up.
Yeah.
Where am I, everybody? Nope. Don't open, fans inside.
I feel like if Philly was left to its own devices, they would eat each other and just basically kill off most of the population.
Yeah. What was that Seth Rogen film, This Is the End? Yeah. It's something like that, where somebody would make Channing Tatum their bitch. And
I love that movie.
That was a very underrated movie.
I thought it was just like really creative. It was fun, you know, but I don't know.
And they went hardcore with it. I love the joke with it. Who was it? Was it Hermione from...
Hermione?
Was she the one... Remember there was a girl
Emma
Watson, yeah. And they were... She got in there and they gave her a room and they're like, all right, guys, whatever, we can't rape her. Why are you talking about rape? No, we're not going to rape her.
And then Michael Cera has got like a huge coke problem. But that's a good movie.
Awesome.
But yeah, I'm rooting for the Patriots. I can't root for the Eagles. So just...
Yeah, it's a...
I can't root for a division rival.
In the end, I mean, I'll probably leave my pick till next week, but it's more likely going to be New England just on the premise of you give Belichick 2 weeks, he will find every loophole there is to win the game.
They're definitely going to win. They could be down, as we saw last year, 28-3, and come back and win. So, but anyway, what does he want? Oh, we must have started podcasting.
OB, I guess, is putting in a Super Bowl prediction.
What, is he trying to get his toys over there? In that big
basket.
Yeah,
he's standing by his toys and wagging his tail.
Oh, pull that basket down for
all
him.
All right, hold on for a sec.
But, my dog, he tends to... I think when Burlow comes over, he forgets that he can do anything on his own. Like, get the toys that are right in front of him. But, I don't know.
I got that effect on people.
Did you eat any Tide Pods this week?
No, I'm afraid I haven't digged into that cuisine yet.
But. Man, that thing's really taken off, man. Every time I go on Facebook, I see about 25 people posting about the Tide Pod thing. It's really
open mic should be fun right now.
Oh yeah.
What's the deal with these Tide Pods?
Well, I didn't have a Tide Pod. I don't know how many people I saw put something up like "Let them eat it, thin the herd." I must have seen that like that joke or that like saying 15 times. But did you ever?
I wonder if Tide is getting like more publicity and money out of this. I mean, think about it. It's great. I mean, they don't say laundry pods. They say Tide Pods. I mean, that somebody's sitting back in management going, oh, this is the greatest publicity stunt ever. People are dying, and they keep on buying our product.
Yeah, I mean, maybe now it'll be like Q-tips, how, you know, like the other pods we're just going to call Tide Pods because of this.
Yeah, like I think other businesses should put something deadly in their things that people were stupidly put in their mouths so they can get more publicity.
So you think someone should...
Yeah, you know how we keep on checking Halloween candy? I think Hershey should just go legit and go razor blade chocolate.
In all those years of Halloween candy, did you ever know anyone that got like a... I remember it used to be like, there's like a... pins in there, and they'd be like, I never knew one person who got a infected Halloween candy.
In fact, they actually did a study, and it's proven that there has never been a case where somebody has snuck anything into like anybody's candy whatsoever to try to kill a child.
You still got time, buddy.
Sadly, that's a victory for the United States. It's like, yes!
This Tide Pod, it's funny... Like, I love these challenges that people come up with. It made me start thinking of, like, the recent ones over the years. Like, remember everybody was planking a couple years ago. And I'm trying to think of some of the others. Remember butt chugging? People were butt chugging.
Oh, yeah. I think we talked about it on the podcast.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I looked up a couple. But I remember – I was just thinking of some of them that, you know, people are going to look back and be like, oh, yeah, my generation, they were eating Tide Pod. Like, you know. Did you ever eat anything, like, crazy? Like, what's the weirdest thing you tried? I ate like a dog biscuit before. I've tried that.
I did that before when I used to do pet vaccination, and like one of the guys on the crew.
You're on break.
Well, that's what they have. Like, Petco has this thing where it's almost like a buffet bar where you like dig up different dog foods and put it in the bag, and they charge you by the pound. And like one of the guys is like, "Oh, screw it, I'm gonna." He just starts chomping it. It's like, dude, what are you doing? He's like, just try it. And I'm like, no, I ain't going to. Just try it. There's some. Oh, that ain't bad.
So did you continue to eat them? Or
no,
was it just
I did not make it a snack during my job.
Well, I could see. I was wondering if that's like where it started all. Like this dog obsession. You know, I tried one bone and it was over.
But then I saw a dog on the other side of the room. I'm like, it's over.
Yeah, I never like ate anything like. Like, that wasn't edible or anything like that, like in a challenge or... I mean, I tried chicken hearts. They were pretty gross. Pig brain.
Yeah, I remember that episode. Yeah.
I remember in high school, maybe, we had like $17 between us. I don't know. And he said he would like eat anything. So we went and like we found like a big jar of ham glaze. And he ate the entire jar of ham glaze in the parking lot of a shop, right?
Oh,
and just puked all over the place. It was amazing.
It's just like the gelatin of
Like that gelatin that you like coat a ham. It was disgusting. It was horrific. But it was great.
I mean, sounds awesome. It was great. I wish I was there, but...
If there was YouTube back then, it would be like a pretty,
pretty
significantly watched video.
And then we'd be talking about all the other hundreds of people ham glazing.
Right. Exactly. Hashtag ham glazing. You know? But I just brought up a few of them. Apparently, these are some of the trends that have been going on social media the last 2 years. The duct tape challenge. This is where a 14-year-old boy in Washington was seriously injured. These are like dangerous challenges, but by playing a popular game known as the duct tape challenge.
Okay.
Skylar Fish. All right. Well, first off, you know Skylar Fish comes from some
He has to be the lead of a crappy ska band.
Either that or he's like just some privileged kid who has like way too much time on his hand because his parents are like, Skylar, come here, Skylar. And his friends tried the challenge before seeing it trending on YouTube, which normally involved duct taping a participant to a pole. So they have to break free. This time, Fish was duct taped standing up. Fish was injured when he tried to break out of his duct tape, causing him to fall and hit his head on a window frame and concrete, a crushed eye socket, a brain aneurysm, and 48 stitches. I don't mind this challenge. Duct taping your buddy to a pole and seeing if he can get out. I like
it. I think that was like when they came down on hazing in the NFL. That was like one of the final things. I remember like when Tim Tebow was with the... The Broncos, I remember, they all the rookies had to get special haircuts. He got the Friar Tuck, where they shaved the entire top of his head but left all the side hair around him like a circle. And I think that's what was also one of the last things, where they would take a rookie and just tape him to the goalpost and like walk off of the vicinity.
I don't mind that one. It seems relatively harmless.
I mean, it sounds like the guy just didn't plan it out.
Yeah,
for lack of a better term. It's like, all right, I got a pull on this, but I got to be careful about the following things.
The cinnamon challenge. I'm sure you've seen that.
I remember that, I never did that one.
I did a spoonful of cinnamon once. I think at like Christmas Eve with my family. Like, it was like, yeah, try it. This can cause throat and respiratory issues, including choking and potential collapse long. Come on. Come on.
No pain, no gain.
Don't mind the cinnamon challenge either. I think that's kind of funny.
Were you able to take it down or did it cough up?
I remember coughing up like a lot and eventually like, I guess it was like you had to finish like a spoonful in a minute or something like that. It was really hard. But I don't know. The choking game. Millennial parents might remember the choking game from the 80s and 90s, but infiltration of Facebook has caused it to spread again like wildfire. The game uses limited strangulation to reduce oxygen to the brain, causing the participant to faint. In 2014, the choking game became a bona fide social media craze among teens, like hashtags like the choking game or the pass out challenge. So,
that's how we lost David Carrigan.
He was playing a different type of choking game, though.
the adult version of the choking game. Poor guy. You know, you got to go, and you're an established actor, and that's how they find you.
There's nothing worse than that.
Seriously, that's one of the things that you got to have like a really tight person with you. It's like, all right, bro, I'm going to be doing this. You got to watch me. Because I do not want to make the news for this.
Yeah, like, your parents find
he's
you
in
like
the afterlife.
Timothy!
The belt. I remember kids when I was young, like doing like that pass out thing. They would like breathe like a whole bunch and like lean against a wall or something, like hold their neck and like pass out. I remember then actually being smart enough to think that was stupid.
You're buzzing?
No, that's just the voices in your head.
I thought I heard a bee or something in here. It was weird. I'm like, this time of season?
Maybe you're losing it.
That's a game I play called Do You Hear the Buzzing?
You want to do the pass out game real quick?
All right, you're Brutus Beefcake. I'm Adrian
Adonis.
Let's
just do all these challenges and post them to, like, years later.
All right, I'm going to get the cinnamon and the Tide Pod together. That'll be delicious.
Car surfing was a challenge recently in 2015.
Thanks, Teen Wolf.
Where passengers surf on the roof, hood, or bumper of a vehicle. It's taken multiple teen lives. In 2015, a 16-year-old Michigan girl died in a parking lot of her work after jumping on a moving car and falling off the vehicle.
You know, you just get one that has, like, a luggage rack up there, and you tie yourself to it, if you fall.
Are we really losing, like, the geniuses? Are we losing?
Yeah, I don't think Steve Jobs is, you know, on the top of his Lamborghini. Woohoo!
I just can't imagine us, like, losing, like, very important people to these things.
You don't know that, Scott. I mean, we can get to the afterlife, and it's like, oh, that was a dude who was going to give us flying cars.
Listen, I said that I did this. My friends were eating ham glaze, and I remember the pass out challenge and cinnamon challenge. And look at me, I am a nobody. I didn't turn out.
I remember one. I forget the football movie. I think it was called The Program, where they would wear all black and lay down in the middle of the streets in between the yellow lines.
Yes. Was that The Program? I think it was The Program.
I think that was the name of the movie.
We'll have to look it up.
Yeah, but I kind of remember that thing where then, like, they had to take it out of the movie a week later because, like, 20 college people died because of it. I wonder why. They all died of cancer. It was a weird coincidence.
Yeah, it had nothing to do with the job.
In honor of these people, we're going to chop up the faculty or the program. That was.
What about the salt and ice challenge?
I've never heard of that one.
So how dangerous can two simple items everyone has in their home really be? The answer is very dangerous. Teens are participating in the salt and ice challenge, requiring only a handful of salt and a few cubes to play. To complete the challenge, the participant must pour salt in their hand, add some cubes, and see how long they could hold the salt and ice together in a closed fist. Some versions of the challenge require friends to hold the salt and ice mixture against a participant's skin. Whoever can hold the salt and ice the longest and endure the most pain wins. Teens are giving themselves second and third degree burns with this dangerous game. Google salt and ice just to see how damaging the results can be.
So how does a margarita work out then? That's kind of weird.
The alcohol is just the lubricant between.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Then I'll just pour a shot in my hand and I'd win.
Yeah. You know? I mean, you should probably do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've already figured it out. So clearly this will work.
Butt chugging and eyeballing.
Eyeballing? Yeah. I don't.
Well, butt chugging, just for those of you who don't know, is basically giving yourself a booze enema. Like, basically,
that's got to be a weird review on Untappd, I got to say. John, I just don't feel what you say about Landshark.
Alcohol poisoning, tissue damage. Yeah, yeah. Untappd would be a lot different if it was all based off.
It's a 4.25 in my mouth. Now, in my butt, I sound 3.5.
So kids have been obviously getting hospitalized, but apparently eyeballing is an equally disturbing teen trend that involves taking a shot of hard liquor in your eye socket.
I enjoy it enough in my mouth. I just don't get where these kids find these things.
Eyeballing can cause irritation, swelling, cornea scarring, and blindness.
Well, we should start a thing for the kids called macing, where we just bring them over to us. And no, this is cool. Everybody does it in the colleges. Yep. And just put pepper spray right in their eyes.
Apparently, some girls have also been soaking their tampons in vodka.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I've had to talk to somebody about that. I don't think I'll get equal results in any hole I have. So.
No.
Yeah. We're going to bring in a guest for that one, Scotty.
I remember in college there was something called like a Chili Willy or something. Something like that. You would take a beer cap full of vodka and like kids would like snort up their nose and see if they can survive it.
I mean, the closest thing I could say is when a part of the Shenanigan Showdown doing those pixie sticks up the nose.
I forgot about that. That was not fun. I did the vodka thing, I remember, on a dare. So I'm basically just one of these kids, just a little older at this point.
Well, that one awful. You kind of go, and then you'll be fine.
Right.
70s
not up
is
your
just,
butt.
Yeah. Nothing butt related. Brutally honest. Anything where you say blah 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 and your butt, I go, let's do the first part, not the second.
Have you heard of trunking? I've never heard of trunking.
No, this sounds new.
Some teens think rules were made for breaking. They've gotten very creative about it. Many states prohibit teens under the age of 18 who have either a learner's permit or driver's license from transporting other teens. Some states call it a graduated driver's license. Blah 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 blah. Black when we were teens. Teens sometimes do this when they have no additional room for their passengers. Trunking is dangerous. I guess they're just carrying their friends' ride in the trunks, so they're not getting caught with like a passenger in the car. So they're just like saying, "Hop in the trunk."
I mean, just sneaking in there. But if you're like drag racing, I guess that might end up as an issue. I mean, maybe if you put a helmet on me, I'll deal with it.
Yeah,
I remember one time, like, my brother had a truck, and me and my dad stayed in the back, and my brother slammed the brakes really hard, and I swear I was seeing stars there for a minute. My dad was laughing at me, and I was like, it's not funny. I don't remember where I live right now, Dad.
Who are you? Who's this man I'm in the back of a truck with?
Woo!
Vampire biting.
Oh.
Some teens taking the Twilight saga a little too far and showing their commitment in very unusual and unsafe way with love bites. Dangerous teen trend is exactly what it sounds like. Teens are biting each other in what can only be described as modern day hickey. Teens who do this are apparently looking for a way to feel closer to their boyfriend or girlfriend. Obviously, the risks are HIV, hepatitis, all that fun stuff.
Now, do they get the implants to go full vampire, or are they just like taking a chunk out of a person?
I'm guessing just chunk, but...
Oh, I get mad because that's zombieing. That's clearly different than vampiring.
Wrong term.
You rookies, god damn it.
And finally, we got condom snorting.
I'm intrigued.
Generally, parents would want their teens to use condoms versus unprotected sex. But in this case, teens are attempting to snort the condom up their nose and then pull it out their mouth.
So they're just taking a plain condom.
Condom. You know, I mean, I guess it could be flavored or
It's glow
in the dark.
I guess the question, is it filled? Was it pre-used?
I mean, I guess it could be.
That's my first thought when you say condom.
If you're going to snort it, I guess you get two uses out of it. I don't know. That's gross.
Son, this is the weirdest way I met your mother.
So, yeah, they're trying to get it, like, basically up their nose and pull it out their mouth.
I really think we should sit down as a unit and come up, just basically grab random... Like, have a pick bag, if you will, of random stuff and whether you can shove it. And we could probably start a trend. Like, we would be the innovators.
We might have to present it a little different than let's find things and see where you can shove it.
That's got to be the premise. Like, when NBC calls us and they want to do a podcast live.
Leave it or shove it?
Yeah. Clearly. Well, I had that British dude on CBS at late night do it. Was it James Corbin?
Oh, yeah. Everyone loves him.
Yeah, exactly. It'll be adorable.
On that note, I don't know, man. I think you should try to do all the challenges and then just see which ones you like best.
Scott, I'm in the trunk right now. I'm chugging something while sipping on a pie top.
My mouth is full of cinnamon. But I think it's time to get to our first guest.
Yeah,
I think enough about butt chugging and
Well, that's an honest leadway to our first guest, obviously.
Yeah. But If you're a basketball fan, you know of this guy. If you were New
15 years in the NBA.
If you're a New Jersey Nets fan or even just like from New Jersey, you probably heard his name. He's one of the biggest superstars other than like Kidd and like Kenyon Martin, like that era. He was like before that. I remember him and Derek Coleman and Drazen. So the one and only Kenny Anderson coming on the podcast. Another awesome athlete that we can add to the resume here.
Absolutely.
So let's get Kenny Anderson on the line.
Right. Shenanigans Hotline.
1-800-BSK.
You, yeah.
Kenny Anderson, what is up? This is Scott and Mike from the Verbal Shenanigans Podcast. How you doing, man?
How y'all doing, man?
We're doing good. Where are we calling you from? Where are you at now?
My bedroom. I'm in Florida.
Oh, Florida.
Yeah.
So, Kenny, one, it's a pleasure to talk to you. So give us a little insight to what is life like? Let's start now and go backwards. What is life like after, you know, post basketball? Is it hard to leave the game? Do you try to stay with the game, or did you just try to do, you know, something completely different and go? Did you try to start a business, or like, is it really hard to just retire and be like, okay, now what do I do this morning?
Yeah, it takes time. You know, me, I stayed with it a little bit. Mm-hmm. As far as with the youth, you know, you always want to give back. You know, I lost my mother about 2005, but she always wanted me to give back and, you know, give off to some of these youth, some of the kids that might have talent, that might be playing basketball or any sport, you know, give them my experiences, you know, try to just give back to it. And, you know, I'm still involved in it somewhat, but after a while, you know, I've been out of the game, NBA, since 2005.
Right.
So it's been some time. You know, my love, you know, I've gotten into, you know, smoking cigars. I've been smoking cigars since 1997 when I was with the Celtics. And, you know, as I created a club, My Guy Cigar Club. And that's something where I bring, you know, I travel to different cigar lounges all over different cities. Try to interact, you know, bring sports and smoking cigars and everything else together. You know, you meet all different type of people, walks of life. You know, silent. I got a silent auction going on while I have this cigar event. So it's, you know, and I'm also giving back
right.
to certain charities of my choice. You know, that evening, you know, if we make, you know, a portion of the money goes to some of the charities that I that's close to my heart that I touch, and that's what I'm also doing in the process of putting my nonprofit, you know, organization together, and that's Kenny Cares, you know, attending, you know, basically to the youth, just giving back. So I to answer you somewhat, I love the game, but I think now, you know, I'm trying to get away from it because right. It's a lot of. It's a lot of politics involved in it, and I want to be there for someone or players or whatever have you. If they want my advice, I'll give it to them. I'm there, but you know, I don't know if I want to be a coach. I might want to be a life coach, but I just don't want to be in that box.
Right.
You know, just to coach. Mm-hmm. I think I can do more for all different type of people.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel you had to, for lack of a better term, kind of relearn how to live life when you moved outside of basketball and try to move out of, like, basketball activities? Like, kind of, or people trying to push you in? No, you got to coach this and do that.
Yeah, I think exactly. I think everybody, you played basketball for 14 years or 20 years, and then maybe you're a basketball player, so as soon as you retire, oh, you're getting into coaching? They always think that's right. something you always have to do. And I'm like, man, I just, you know, don't want to really, you know, I thought I did. See, and this is where after, you know, retiring and sitting down and, you know, I had to go through a lot. You know, I came out with my documentary, Mr. Chibs, the Kenny Anderson story, and I expressed a lot of my feelings and was real raw, done the right way though. Jill Campbell was the director.
Yeah.
But that kind of tells you a little about myself, you know, what life was like when I was playing basketball and so on and being that child prodigy at a young age. But I think you get burnt out, man. Mm-hmm. You get burnt out. you know, if you, you always, you know, you've been on a pedestal your whole life.
Right.
And then when you, once it's over, you know, people are looking at you a lot different, and you got to really, like, you know, who you trust, who you can't trust. You know, you've been burnt a lot in your life, so you lose a lot of trust in people. And you know, you just have to, like, live again, you know what I mean? And it takes time. And what I'm trying to do is, what am I passionate about?
Right.
You know what I mean? Because I want to do stuff that I'm passionate, that I love and like. So when I wake up in the morning, you know, I can, like, you know, I love doing it. I'm motivated with it. And not just going to, you know, working when I need to get a check. And I think late in my career, that's what was going on. And that's why I didn't want to play no more.
Right.
Because it was like a job. I didn't like it no more. I wasn't happy no more. And I think once something is not, you're not happy doing something, when the passion is gone, I think it's time for you to get, you know, do something else with your life. And I'm still searching. I'm still touching. I'm still touching, feeling things out. But, you know, I'm just trying to, in the meantime, you know, I got some teenagers, my son and my daughter, my wife, and just be, you know, be productive husband and be a good husband, be a good father, and just figure out, you know, what I really want to put my all into.
Yeah, I always find that fascinating. We've had the we've been lucky to talk to Mo Vaughn and Trent Dilfer and a lot of athletes, and you know, it's amazing. You know, you play this sport at the highest level for a long time, but you're still young when you retire. You're you know, I have friends who are 40 years old that, you know, that are still trying to figure out what do I want to do. And you put a career, you put in a whole career towards one thing. I find it so fascinating to see what a player does. Like when now the playing's done, do I want to stay with this game or do I want to completely reinvent myself?
See, I talk about this to a lot of the youth. You know, like you said, reinvent yourself. A lot of these young guys, these young studs now that's playing, the top players, the LeBrons, KD, Stephen Curry, Wade, all these young guys, you know, they're doing it right. They're branding themselves while they're playing. You know, back in the 90s, the 80s, we didn't do none of that. You know, I didn't do a good job of branding myself or building bridges, you know, building relationships. So then when I retire, my transition could be a lot easy. Mm-hmm. Now I'm branding now when I'm finished retiring. And that's not as easy, because once you leave and them doors are shut, it's hard to knock on them doors and they get reopened.
Right.
So it's a different thing that I'm going. And sometimes you got to go away from that, you know, and the lead is great. The lead's been great for me. I had a great run, made a lot of money, a lot of popularity all over the world. But, you know, sometimes you just got to go away from that, meaning you just got to just do your own thing and search for your own passion. And that's who I was before. I got to live with that. You know, like I'm not Kenny Anderson, the basketball player, no more. I'm, you know, Kenny Anderson, the husband, the father, and I'm just trying to be a better citizen and whatever that leads into, you know, I'll figure it out. But whatever it is, I got to be passionate about doing it.
Well, let me ask you a little bit about your career. I mean, obviously you came out of high school. You were ranked one of the number one players in the country. You're ranked higher than Shaquille O'Neal. How was your mind process, would you say, during that? Did you get into the hype? Did you kind of just lay low and just say, this is just part of me playing basketball and happy to get an opportunity? How is that like when you get so much attention when you're in high school?
Yeah, is there any ability to be humble at all, like, at that time?
Yeah, I think I am as a human being. I joke around a lot, but I just think me, my personality and everything, I was always humble. I was always blessed. I just had great supporting team. Mm-hmm. Jack Curran, my high school coach, was a legend. Vincent Smith, my mentor, Pierre Turner. You know, they kind of, you know, had me leveled. My head was leveled. And that's where, you know, being that child prodigy from New York, I was been getting basketball attention my whole life since I was 10 years old. And that's when it was love, though. It seems like that's when I loved the game. You know, it was, you know, I just played it, man, for to get my mother out of the struggle. I felt that I was good at something. I was pretty good at something, and I just took advantage of it. That's it.
Now, Let me ask you. So we're doing this podcast from Jersey. My brother was a diehard Net fan. I remember he had you and DC on the wall, and you coming from New York City and then, you know, going to Georgia, but coming back, coming to Jersey. Did you enjoy your time in Jersey? Like, it's funny because, like, I'm a big Devil fan, and they always talk about, like, players, like, they get here, and they're like, wow, it's not that bad. Like, there's a lot of other parts of Jersey that people don't see.
People,
What was it like playing in Jersey?
I loved it, man. Tell you the honest truth, man. Like you said, at Jersey, I got so many memories. My second daughter was born in Jersey. You know, my daughter, Chrissy, she's 24 years old. She was born in Meadowlands Hospital. Right there, it's a caucus. I loved it, man. I was close to New York City.
Right,
I did both parts: New Jersey, the suburbs, and I went into the city. I had you know, both worlds, man. Was, you know, people that covered me in high school, all my friends and families I could see just go over the bridge. You know, it took me 45 minutes or an hour. Maybe to get to my old neighborhood in Queens.
Right.
You know, it was great. But sometimes, you know, maybe it was too much at times, but I enjoyed it. Maybe the distractions got me a little bit early in my career, but I don't make no mistake. I don't make no, you know, no complaints, man. I can't complain, man. I got drafted number 2 pick back to my home metropolitan area. So I was excited, and it all, you know, as far as the organization, I love the Nets, love playing with Derek Coleman, Drazen Petrovic. We had something special, it just wasn't long enough. I just got drafted to an unstable organization with like 7 owners. And I don't just think they wasn't really serious. You know, we just wanted to stay in mediocre, you know, it just wasn't. And that's not my fault. People say, hey, I wonder what happened. Why y'all didn't do this? Why y'all didn't play? It just wasn't a stability. It just wasn't a stable organization. That was it.
Yeah. I mean, being from Jersey, I think it's a crime that they're not there. You know, they're in Brooklyn. Yeah. There's already a team there. Like, they just it seems as the onlooker, they just never put it together to go full force on that gas pedal. Like, and they were close a couple times, but the consistency never seemed there.
Exactly. That's definitely wasn't there. When I was there, we had 7 owners. I think it got better. You know, they build a champion. They build a practice facility. That's when Jason Kidd era.
Yeah.
That's when they really put all out. They went all out.
Right.
They got the stability. We didn't have that stability. You know, me, Derek, and Drazen Petrovic, and the coaches was coming and going, and play. It just wasn't stable. You know what I mean? But all in all, I love playing for the Nets.
Right. Now, you brought up the name that was literally going to be my next question. Here in Jersey, you hear the name Drazen Petrovic, and it still holds this little like folklore about it. Like, oh my God! Like, if he didn't pass away, what could the Nets have been? And you know, he brought a lot of interest to the game between you, Derek Coleman, and Drazen. It was like, wow, okay, we got something. They have something good here. What was Drazen like, and did you guys feel the same thing? Like, wow, this guy is special. Like, because he has this like iconic folklore here, and I don't know if that's because he passed too early or he was just that good.
He was that good. Number one, and number two, he was a European guard. He was like Michael Jordan over in Europe before he got over here. And rest in peace, man. Drazen, it's just tough. He was very quiet, hard worker. He just wanted to belong. He just wanted to come over here to let people know, like, hey, I made the NBA. I just didn't make it. I played and performed on a higher level. And for that reason, you know, by him getting that accident, you know, getting killed, it messed us up. We was gone. You know, that's when the Nets, I thought another year or two, he was about to sign an extension. You know, that summer they was about to sign him.
Right.
And we was going to be together, you know, for at least 2 to 3 more years. I know that for sure, me, Derek, and him. And that just would have been something because we was building on something. Even though we was in the Michael Jordan era, the Bulls was good, but we was competing with the Knicks, the Bulls, Cleveland Cavaliers, Pacers, Orlando, with Shaq. And we was right there. It was battles. So you never know what would have happened if he would have signed that deal and extension with the Nets and would have went on and did some great things together. I believe that.
What were your thoughts on the Nets fan base? Because there's always been this word that the reason they moved to Brooklyn was just because, you know, even when the Nets went into the NBA Finals, they were still having struggles selling out their arenas and so forth. What were your thoughts on the New Jersey fans, and do you think they should have stayed here?
Well, they treated me well. That's when I first started my career. You know, 94, I was an all-star. Mm-hmm. My fans, they voted me a starter. So I was a starter, and so I was real popular there. I just think they did have some problems with the arena. Where it's located. Yeah. That's all. You just couldn't get out there without driving. You needed to drive, and I just think that's hard. Mass transit. If we was able to get out there and things like that, I think it would have been a lot different.
I just wish they went to the Prudential Center. That was the move. I mean, that place is beautiful, and it was set up for them. Mass transit right to Newark. Mm-hmm. I feel like they really fumbled that deal, and that would have been, stay with the Devils. It would have been, I really think that was a bad move by them. But I guess they're doing well in Brooklyn, but I don't know.
I don't know as far as the ticket sales and how the money is there. I didn't look into all of that, but... You know, it's always going to have its Barclays Center, Brooklyn. You got the train there. You know, you got walk-ups that different types. So you just never know,
Now, Kenny, you played for a lot of teams after you left the Nets. The Hornets, the Blazers, the Celtics, my Seattle Supersonics. That was my team. Yeah. The Hornets, the Pacers, the Hawks, the Clippers. So you had a position that there's always a need for a smart guard, smart point guard. Who can play the game. Was it hard for you moving around so much? Because, you had that stint with the Celtics for 4 years, but then it seems like every
5 years. My love was to the Nets, Blazers, and Celtics.
Right.
Because I put my handprint on those three teams.
Yeah.
So that's when I'm playing 35-plus minutes. Mm-hmm. I'm able to be, able to do some things. You know what I mean? So the Blazers, I played for two years, and the Nets, five, and Celtics, five. It was most of my years. So I've always say that, those are the three teams that I put my handprint on. But all the other teams, I was always able to do some things there. I played the second half of the season. First half of the season with the Pacers, I played the whole season, the whole first half as a starting point guard. And we lost to Detroit in the Eastern Conference Finals. Uh-huh. And I thought, that was a good year. I played there for a year. Then everybody else, I played for half a year everywhere else. But like you said, being a point guard, you definitely got to be some type of specialist. You got to adjust to different situations. You're dealing with different coaches, different players. You got to get guys the ball. You got to set guys up offensively. Then you got to play a little defense. So it is a real difficult position to move around. But I think that's when, I lost my passion along the way after getting traded. Every time you look at my career, except the New Jersey, I wanted to leave because Drazen and Derek Coleman was leaving. I was on the island by myself. But all the other trades I was playing some of my best ball.
Right.
It got traded. So I was like, I don't know what I got to do. I led the Celtics to the Eastern Conference Final. Mm-hmm. Ironic against the Nets. against the Celtics, we lost.
Right.
But I get traded in the summertime because of business. The owner, Paul Gaston, was selling the team to the new owners, the Celtics that have now. They needed to, lose my contract in that. Portland, I was playing some of my best ball, got traded there. That's how I wound up in Boston. So, after a while, and I tell you the type of person I am mentally, after a while, it gave on me, man. I'm tired. I'm just tired of traveling. I'm tired of getting traded. I'm tired. And, I just lost my passion for it. My last year, I really didn't really like going to practice. Didn't really want to be in the building. I didn't even be, I just didn't want to play no more. And that's what I tell my son. I said, hey, man, I lost the passion, for it. That's why when you lose passion for something, it's time to do something else.
Well, that's kind of interesting. I mean, you talk about losing the passion, but you eventually tried out and played in Lithuania. I'm just kind of curious.
Yeah, that's when my mother passed away in 2005. Mm. That's when I retired. And I said, damn, that hit right on nose. I said, shit, I can get out of this country for 5 months. That's what happened. Okay. You know what I mean? So I went out of the country when my mother passed, got a clear head, got a great experience playing over in Lithuania. Was awesome, but that wasn't for me, you know, playing in Europe. And you practice more than you play. You know, you play like once a week. You practice twice a day. But it was a great experience, something that, you know, I can always remember, but... I was just doing it to get out of the country and to clear my head. You know, it came at a good time.
Now, what are your thoughts on the game now? You obviously see there's a couple of things. You see the super teams or whatever you want to call them. They always try to get the big three. The same teams dominate. And also you see a totally different game when it comes to the physicality of it, like going through the paint and getting fouls. Do you still love the game? Do you still love watching the game? Or do you think it's almost like a complete different game from when we watched the Nets versus the Knicks and the Knicks versus the Pacers? It was going to the paint, you needed a helmet. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I just think the game needed to change.
Right.
Got some young studs, young athletic, you know, guys, fan friendly. You got to make the lead. Run and gun, you know, they love the entertainment side of it.
Yeah.
It changes somewhat when the playoffs start. But in our era in the 90s, it's very tough. You know,
I can only imagine.
You can't, you know what I mean? You know, some of those games was hard on the eyes. And I understood it. You know, it was more competitive. You know, guys, you know, 85 to 80, you know, 79 to 75. You know, it was like defensive battles. Who can hold each other better than, you know, that's basically what they were doing. I started holding. You just start learning all type of tricks, you know, you know, when you play to win. So, no, but they had to change. It's making a lot of money now. It's a $1 billion business.
Yep.
The guys are moving all around now. Free agents is, you know, star players can move. They can play with each other. They can say, hey, I want to go here next year, play with this guy. You know, we really couldn't move around like that, you know, in the 90s. Yep. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and, I can't even imagine, like, being you, know, you like, going, like, driving the paint and, like, Charles Oakley sitting there with his elbows. Yeah. Like, I can't even imagine.
It was brutal, man.
It's like Sparta.
It was brutal, man. You got to, you had to brace yourself, and you knew night in and night out, you know, games was going to be rugged. That's basically, you had to take care of yourself.
Now, let's talk about now a little bit. You mentioned, we talked about at the beginning of the interview, but what is Mr. Chibs? We see you with the shirts on and the name.
Mr. Chibs is the name. Mr. Chibs is my nickname, man. My mother named me that when I was 5 days old. Means nothing. It's just really dear to me and my mother in New York and Queens, everywhere they call me Chibs. So when I did something good, my mother called me Mr. Chibs. But I was 5 days old, and when they brought me in to show her, me, her mouth was full. She said, Cheeks, Chibs. It came out Chibs. She was eating. She said, Chibs, and she stuck with it. I didn't know my name was Kenneth until kindergarten, first day of kindergarten, when she was filling out the paperwork. So everybody in New York, true story. So everybody in New York and my family, you know, my whole family called me Chibs. There was this other, they called me Chibs. But, you know, it got to the point where it grew on me and my neighborhood and friends and Left Rack City, where I'm from. Chibs. That's just what it is. And my mother just added Mr. Chibs, very dear to me and my mother. So I named my documentary Mr. Chibs.
Yep.
So that's what it's about, man. And it's on Amazon now. You can check it out. You should watch it. It's really deep, man. Really raw, telling the truth. But I think everybody should watch it to understand how a kid, you know, a child prodigy, make it to the NBA and all the things he has to go through. So it's kind of neat.
I checked out some of it, and you talk about the abuse and some of the stuff you're dealing with now and your extended family. Just out of curiosity, when like people like us contact you and say, hey, we want to talk to you, out of curiosity, do you feel more comfortable talking about stuff that you dealt with in the documentary or the time that you had in basketball?
Both now. I'm really comfortable in my skin. I wasn't, you know, before I was, you know, now I'm comfortable. I think my documentary did a lot for me.
Yeah.
Therapy. I go once a week anyway, you know, sit down and lay on the couch and express myself. And I tell everybody, you're going through stuff, man. You got to get some professional help. You know, don't talk to your friends and your family because they sometimes could want to use it against you. But if you go get some professional help, when you're paying and your insurance is paying or you paying, those, you know, people are confidentiality. That's what they do. That's their job. You know what I mean? So it's more private where you can just release and they can help you. They're professionals with it instead of just talking to a friend, somebody you think you can trust, and they bring and they just talk. You know, they talk about you, whatever. So, you know, it's if you're out there and you're struggling with life, really, man, get some help, man. Don't try to do it all by yourself. You know, you got to get some help and you got to get some professional help. And that's basically my documentary, real deep. I go into that. I go into all type of things. But I'm comfortable with talking about a lot of different things. And before I did my doc, I had to sit there and think, you know what? Am I going to sacrifice myself to help somebody? And that's all I did because I didn't want to lie. I didn't want to cheat them. I said, I got to give these people the real Kenny Anderson. So maybe somebody suffering could get some help. And that's about all I did. You know what I mean? It just sacrificing to help others. That's what all, because all of us got stories. Some of us are just embarrassed and ashamed to come out and say it to help. You got to leave that alone. So maybe you can help somebody else. And that'd be more. At the end of the day, that'll be more. It ain't going to be Kenny Anderson. And I get it down. Like, oh, man, you played great. You was great, guard. That ain't nothing, man, compared to somebody say, dude, you helped me, man. Thank you for your story. You know, I needed that. I was about to jump off the bridge. I was about to commit. I was about to lose it, man. And I heard you speak and on the abuse and on everything.
More than basketball, right?
It's more than basketball.
It's more than being a good point guard.
Yes. And it hits home. And I'm like, wow, man, that's deep, you know, for me, the feeling
for sure.
People say that. So, and that's what I'm searching for right now. Basketball is great. That helped me. And one thing I always say, it helped me and my mother get out of the struggle because they had the infrastructure, the NBA to, you know, make a lot of money. You could take care of your family. Right. That's what it was all about for me. It was get my mother out of the struggle. And I did that.
And it's great, and we highly recommend people checking out the documentary. One last basketball question. I know we're kind of tight on time with you, but I got to ask you, when you went over to North Korea, how scary or was it exhilarating or was it just, oh, my God, I'm in North Korea?
What is that experience like, man?
It was a great experience, to tell you the truth. I did some stuff with Dennis. Dennis Rodman talked to me. He did some stuff for me with my kid camps. And he said, hey, man, I didn't even pay attention. I'm not political. I don't even know North Korea. I didn't even know until I went over there. You know what I mean? I really was, like, real ignorant, you know, about the whole situation and my wife. We didn't really do our research or anything like that. I just thought we were going over to China, whatever, and, you know, go be ambassadors of basketball.
Right.
You know, that's what I've been doing. And actually, you know, the people, you know, the leader over there, you know, I found out all that stuff when I was over there. And, you know, he hated America. And he's a crazy dictator. It's the last communist country is North Korea. So it was a very unique, you know, in a way, I'm glad I survived it. We came over here. We came back home.
Us too, man.
And nothing that didn't happen. And then in a way, it's like, you know what? I've been over there. So I did something that a lot of us say, you know, nobody's done but a few, you know.
That's
so
for sure.
It was very interesting. And they really took care of us, to tell you the truth. You know what I mean? They took care of us, you know what I mean, over there. And we had some time. We did a clinic over there with their national team, you know. And then we played, you know. It wasn't as bad as it seemed.
Yeah.
But like I said, I wasn't, you know, I'm not into the government, the politics. Yeah. I just didn't know. And I know now, though. You know what I'm saying? I know now. I said, oh, shit, I was over there. You know, I got the picture, you know, that we took with Kim Young, with the leader, but my wife won't let me put it up. So it's like, it's really, it's in the drawer. We can't put it up.
You got to tweet it.
I can't put it up.
But Kenny, thank you so much for coming on. Your story's inspirational. It's also cool to have basically like a New Jersey guy, like, I know you're not a Jersey guy, but a New Jersey legend, you know, like, yeah, that people still talk about. Like, well, remember when the Nets had Anderson in D.C.? Yeah. Just really, really cool to have you on, man. If people want to go check you out or say hi or look at what you're doing, where can they go?
They, they know I'm a Twitter addict, man. Just Chibs_1 is my Twitter page. Instagram is Kenny Anderson 7357. And my Facebook, Mr. Chibs, you know, .com, is Facebook. So, you know, you can go to my website, MrChibs.com, and we can buy merchandise, my documentary. But you also can check me out, my Guy Cigar Club, that I do, you know, a lot of, events all over the world and different things like that. But you can check on my website, MyGuyCigarClub.com, and just check me out. But I'm always on Twitter. Just always, you know, reaching. And I love Twitter because I reach out to all of my fans and let them know I'm doing well.
We could vouch for that. Yeah, you got in touch with us in seconds. Yeah.
I let them know I'm doing well. Let them, you know, give them positive vibes. And then that's all. You know, I told my guys, I don't want no mess. Don't be talking crazy on here. So I'm going to block you. That's all I do. I'm going to block you. You know what I mean? And so, yeah, I love interacting, but you start talking crazy, I got to block you.
But no, man. There's a lot of those out there.
Follow me on Twitter. And, you know, thanks for having me on. This is awesome.
Awesome.
Very laid back.
Yeah, it's our first Sonic on the podcast.
Yeah, technically, I bet you would never say in a million years Kenny Anderson.
It's also, I didn't remember it until, like, I was, you know, Googling some background info on him. He was there for a very split
post Sean Kemp years.
Yeah, he got traded with, like, Vin Baker and all those guys. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he was on a lot of teams, man. It's crazy.
Yeah, that's got to be tough for some of them guys, and I'll want to continue
uprooting
their
family and uprooting your. I mean, I'm sure they have a home base that they go back to, but it can't be easy just going away, well, coming home, away, come home. All right, we're moving.
You look at, like, when he played for New Orleans, I think he only played 4 games for them, and then he was done with them. So it's got to be, like, almost frustrating. It's like, you go to the team, you probably traveled twice in those 4 games, and then you come back, it's like, it's over?
I know. But just a really cool interview. So go check out Mr. Chibs, the documentary. It's pretty deep. So anyway, Berlew, I think it's time for a guest.
Let's do
another guest here. Olympics coming up. You a big Olympic guy? I like the Olympics. I like the Winter Olympics.
Yeah, I think the Winter Olympics have more fun stuff, where summer is basically basketball and that's it. I mean, unless there's some huge name in, like, sprint and track and field, it's pretty much just basketball.
Yeah. So we have a pretty cool guest coming on the show here. His name is John Morris, and he is a curler. Canadian curler. He was in the Vancouver Olympics. Very decorated. I mean, I don't know anything about curling, but if you just, like, you see all this career numbers on Wikipedia, just like lots of championships. A comic by the name of Dean Gemmel put me in touch with him. He has a curling podcast. Like, it's all just, like, about curling. So I don't know if he still does it, but Dean, if you do it, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of my first questions, is, like, how much material did you have going into this?
He was a curler, like, pretty high-level curler, and he just interviewed different curlers. And I guarantee there's an audience for that, which, unlike us, we have no direction. We just have everybody we could possibly have on the show.
Spoon collectors. Right. That's our niche. We should get into that.
I mean, we had the Chinese food collector guy on, so, you know. But anyway, by the name of John Morris, so I'm excited to get him on, so let's give him a call.
Let's do it.
Yeah, man. So, John, thanks for giving us a few minutes here, and welcome to the show. This is my buddy Mike here, so just so you know, we're calling you from the great state of New Jersey.
Right on. Thanks, guys. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be on, and I've heard a lot about the show, so I'm excited to be part of it.
Yeah, man. It's interesting. I reached out to Dean, who it's not too often you find another comic who also has this life in the sport of curling. But I was like, I want to get a curler on the show. And you were the first name that he suggested. So I'm looking forward to it here.
Yeah, Dean's a great fellow. He's actually a good curler himself, too. So he brings a lot to the game.
Now, let me ask you something. So curling, like, obviously is not a sport in America that the common person, some don't even know about it, but or that think it's not very available. Now, you're Canadian. How big is curling as like an everyday sport there?
Well, I guess compare it to soccer in Europe. It's 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 real close to hockey. Hockey up here.
Really?
In Canada rules all, and yes. Then but curling is real close, as far as the viewers are concerned and the amount of popularity and fan support in Canada. It's
really
it's right up there, you bet. It's they're sort of one and two as far as Canadian support goes, and if you ever come up here on any given weekend from the months of September until April, you turn on our sports networks and you'll see, either hockey or curling on for sure.
Now, do you I know it says on your bio that your mom and dad were inventors of a certain curling broom. So I'm guessing you came from a curling family from the start.
Yeah, we were a very big sports family. Like I played hockey and baseball and, almost any sport under the sun growing up. And, but curling stuck, it's sort of, it's whatever you're sort of good at as you're getting older and going through your teens, and curling was my best sport. And so I stuck with it, and, I'm glad I did, cause, I wouldn't have the chance to go to a couple Olympics and, meet a lot of great people, through this game. So.
Now, is this a game where you just play it on like a local pond at home, or do they have little leagues of curling? How do you start into the sport?
Well, it starts and you throw these rocks called little rocks. So they're about a third of the weight and a little bit smaller of the stones you throw when you're in the men's and women's league. So you start with these little rocks and you start usually on a Sunday. On the weekend there's a junior curling league. And I remember when I first, what got me into it, really got me hooked was when I was about 12 years old, I was in one of my first they call tournaments bond spiels. So I was in my first bond spiel up here in small town, and we won a Nintendo. First prize was a Nintendo. So
sweet.
When I was 12 and I won a Nintendo, I was like, oh my God, this is the coolest sport ever. So I was hooked, and I stuck with it, and those Nintendo started turning into a few dollars. So it was sure nice. It's a pretty cool sport.
Now, when did it start to separate for you from like, hey, it's a hobby or something that you play on the weekends or whatever it is, like kind of in leagues, to like, hey, maybe I'm, in the upper echelon of competitors? Because obviously, if it's so popular and you were able to eventually make it to the Olympics, you had to be pretty good at it. When did you start to like, did that actually become an idea in your head that maybe I can go as far as possible with this?
Well, I think that first happened when I watched the Olympics on TV in 1998. That was when curling was, was in the Olympics for the first time. So I remember watching that. I was in high school at the time, and I remember saying, I want to make it there one day. This is my new goal. And then I started, I started curling on my weekends, not every weekend, but, typically I'd be missing out on parties in high school and university because I was going curling, and I felt like the only way I could justify that and make up for that, because I was missing some pretty good times with some good friends, was to, reach the pinnacle of the sport so they'd all understand why I made those sacrifices. And then I remember when I was, in my late teens, I started winning a few events where first prize was like trip to Switzerland with my team. I thought that was really cool, and we were representing Canada and Switzerland at a young age. And then next year we made it to the World Junior Championships, and so that's when it really hit me. It was in my late teens and early 20s that I can really make a difference in this game and be a game changer and hopefully realize my goal of getting to the Olympics one day.
Now, when you start, do you always become the stone thrower, the skip, if I have the term correctly, or is it, or do some people actually start off being the sweepers?
Well, when I first started, and what you'll see in mixed doubles this year, if you guys watch it on NBC this year at the Olympics, is that when you first start out, you throw, you learn to throw and you learn to sweep at the same time, because you have to have some ability to sweep. You know, it's part of the game. Even if you're a skip, you have to sweep even 5 feet. So, you know, it sort of goes hand in hand. So when I first started, I would throw a rock, I would get up, I would sweep my own rock, and then, you know, you sort of develop a skill set. You know, some guys become better hitters, and they're not as good at finesse, but they're really good hitters, so they become the seconds. And usually those are the guys that are really good sweepers as well. They have a lot, you know, they have quite a bit of strength. And then you have guys that are sort of like the quarterback, which they really are good at strategy and seeing the angles out there. And those are the guys that really make good back-end players, which is, you know, a vice skip or a skip. So it's sort of, you know, you start out doing both, and then as you get into it and years down the road, you sort of develop and hone your skills into a certain position.
Now, give us, like, Americans who have no idea about the game some things that we don't know, like as far as common misconceptions, I'm sure, are, hey, you just slide this rock into a target, and what kind of like training and skills and how much time are people, you know, devoting to this game, and what are some common misconceptions that like people who have no idea about the sport like ask you or think?
So first common misconception is when we're playing in curling bonspiels or tournaments, we don't stay in igloos after the games. We actually stay in hotels after the
games. Yeah, that was my next question.
Damn, cross that one off the list.
Yeah, I was going to ask how big your igloo was.
I just
was.
Had to throw that in there. No, a lot of the misconceptions about curling. Actually, when I first went down to Florida when I was young with my family, I remember playing shuffleboard down at a resort. Mm-hmm. And shuffleboard is actually pretty similar to curling, but it's sort of shuffleboard on ice, and it's a bit more complicated.
Yeah.
You know, one common misconception about curling is you burn about 600 to 700 calories per curling game.
Really?
Which is, we usually play two or three a day when we're in an event. So that's, you know, an extra 20, you know, over 2,000 calories we're burning a day. So that's something that when you watch curling, you think it's a very leisurely sport that might not, you know, a lot of people didn't give us a lot of credit initially, but you burn, you know, a lot of calories, and it's a very athletic sport. You watch curling this year at the Olympics, you watch these athletes because they're, you know, they're in the gym 5 days a week at least, and it's quite a bit different than people would think.
Well, what kind of costs are in this sport? Do you purchase your own stones when you go to tournaments? Do they provide them the sweeps? What kind of costs are we looking at? And if there's like uniforms or special shoes?
Well, that's a good question there. Back in the day, curlers and curling teams used to bring their own stones, and that was until about 1950. And then curling clubs and arenas would buy their own stones so that they would have them available for the players. But that stones are important because unlike a hockey puck where they're all made the same, stones are a vital part of the game, and some stones curl more and some stones curl less. So if you don't have a good set of stones that you're playing with, then it can really play havoc on your strategy and your success. So that's one important factor. And the other one, what we wear on our shoes is we have one called a slider. So one that's really slippery. It's usually made of steel or Teflon, and that is a really slippery part of on the ice. And the second part, shoe would be a gripping shoe. So essentially you can grip really hard on the ice with one shoe, and on the second one, second shoe, you can slide across the ice, and that really gives us, allows us to really do our thing out there and catch up to rocks, but stop when we need to. So, and the last thing I'll say is that the ice isn't like your normal hockey ice. It's flat, right? That you just, you know, when you run a Zamboni over, it's nice and clear, but flat. With curling ice, there's something on top called pebble. So there's a pebbling can that's sort of, if I could compare it to anything, it'd be like a flower watering can that, you know, the old school ones. That
right.
Right, so you put hot water in that, and then that's what creates the surface of the ice. And if you don't have a good pebbling can, or if you don't have any pebble on the ice, the rock would never make it 10 feet. That's what creates less friction with the ice, with the rock, and as a result, you don't have to throw it 100 miles an hour to get down the ice. It glides along it, really smoothly, and that's called pebble. So that's crucial as well for curling ice.
Interesting. Now, when you made it to your first Olympic Games, obviously that's got to be a major accomplishment. But what was the Olympic experience like, and how intense is it, and did you, was it like, were you were super nervous the whole time, or did you, was it like a big party? Like, give us a little insight to what it's like to be an Olympian.
Well, the Olympics were the best months of my life, the best experience I've ever had. And you know, every day it got better. I remember, I don't know if you know Chris Pronger, he's one of the best defensemen in the NHL. So, you know, like my first couple of days in the village, I'm working out with Chris Pronger in the gym, and then you know, in the Canada sort of little suite we had in a building we had, at the top was our sort of athletes lounge. Mm-hmm. So hanging out with all these other Canadian athletes, I remember playing ping pong with Marc-Andre Fleury and Shea Weber and Sidney Crosby, you know, and that doesn't happen at a lot of curling events. So that was really cool. I just, you know, doing things like that. Our prime minister, or Wayne Gretzky, actually came and watched some of the curling games with the prime minister. You know, things like that were really cool. One of the most interesting things, and one thing I'll never forget from the Olympics is, you know, at curling events in Canada, they're usually it's a very gentleman sport, and it's very respectful. So, like, when a guy's going to shoot, it's usually very quiet in there. And then, you know, sometimes it gets a little boisterous after shots, but for the most part, you know, it's a very respectful crowd. And at the Olympics, and I'll never forget this, there was just sports fans from all over the world there. And it was just like 5,000 fans, which isn't a lot. Usually, you know, some events we have 20,000.
Right.
But 5,000 fans, and they were going, you know, during our delivery, as we're, you know, usually when it's dead quiet, it was just, you know, absolute, you know, there was no holds barred in there. And that's one of the coolest memories for me. And I remember
it's like Happy Gilmore.
The Happy Gilmore of curling at the time. And I remember at one point, there was so much pride because we were doing well in the event. There's so many great Canadian fans that we were in the middle of the game and they broke out in the, you know, the Canadian anthem. And I remember one of my teammates who was in the hack getting ready to throw, he said, "Johnny, you know, like, what do I do? They're singing the anthem." Like, the whole crowd was singing it. And so we you know, we're on the timer too. So, but I looked up at the timer. I said, "You know what? We got a lot of time." And we just took a step back. We soaked it all in. And I remember listening and singing along to that anthem, and that was some of the coolest memories I had from those games.
So how do you do you just by yourself qualify, or do you have a whole team that comes with you to the Olympics? Kind of describe that.
No, for curling, how it works is you have to build a team, and it's not like you know, our hockey team. They'll select individuals to create a team and have maybe a little bit of a pre-camp for the tryouts. But for curling, it's you build a team for a 4-year run, and everyone's goal when they're building a competitive team is to make the Olympics. And so you know you have to stick with that team, and if that made the best team win, and then. So it's a little bit different, the process, but I like it. You know, you don't have maybe the best absolute four curlers that play together, but you have guys that really work well together that are in good, you know, in good comfortable positions on that team. And the depth in Canada is, you know, I would say out of the top 10 teams in the world, I would say 7 or 8 of them are from Canada. So the depth is vital. You know, it's so difficult and challenging to win. So when you do win your country and you do win Canada, represent curling at the Olympics, you know, it's the cream of the crop, and that prepares you just as well as any event could, because it's such a difficult and challenging event to win.
Now, I'd be remiss, like you were saying, how it's like this gentlemanly game, but of course there's this competitive fire, and I was able to see a clip of you snapping a broom in half, being very emotional about it. Even Dean said, you know, in your younger days, you were kind of known as maybe a little bit of a hothead or very intense. How intense does it get? Like, is it were you like the exception, or is that like most guys?
Well, that was that was about 10 years ago now. I used to have a bit of a fire. I still do. I think that. You know, being able to have that fire, but you know, playing on the edge has always been important for me, because if I don't have that fire, I don't play as well. And if I have too much of it, then, you know, shit sort of hits the fan. But You know, as far as, you know, that was concerned, I was in a tournament and I wasn't playing well. Like, I'd never do that, you know, in anger at my teammates or anything.
Right.
Or, you know, at my opposition. I was angry at myself because I wasn't playing how I wanted to play. And I missed a really vital shot against Manitoba in the Brier. And I took the broom and I just broke, I two-handed it over my knee. And didn't realize, like, I forgot, you know, I looked up because, you know, you never know which, there was four games going on, so I didn't know which game was on TV. I looked up at the big screen, the Jumbotron, and they were replaying that in slow motion on the Jumbotron. And then it's I felt it was the closest I've ever felt to, like, the opposing goalie in another, you know, if you're a visiting team. Because we were in Ontario, and at the time we were representing Alberta, so we were, like, sort of like the arch rivals of Ontario. And I remember for the rest of the game, I remember hearing the jeers, like they were saying, Morris. It was awesome. My buddies who don't even watch curling are like, because I guess, you know, the next couple days I was on the Sports Center top 10 or like broom. So they were showing like Bo Jackson's bat over his knee. Yeah, they were showing like hockey sticks being broken over the boards. And then a curl, I think I made a top 3 on the Sports Center top 10 for best equipment break. So my buddies were like, I never watched curling and now I love it. So it was, you know, I'm sure a lot of the old ladies didn't love it, but I guess if it gets some younger folks interested in the game, I guess it's a good thing.
Listen, world championships and Olympic appearances and medals are all great, but top 3 in the breaking equipment category is something to brag about.
Right behind Bo Jackson, I'll take it.
Now, what was more emotional, the time you went to Olympics and you won the silver medal, or the two times that you missed out on the Olympics?
You know what? I've been, you know, there's times in your career where you feel like, you know, like that more down than you ever could in life. Like, you know, you think that it's the be all and end all. And I know that I've definitely had a few of those moments. I've lost Canadian championships. I've lost Canadian junior championships. I've lost, you know, world championship finals. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a terrible feeling. You know, you get a pat on the back and a good try and you'll get them next time. But it's, you know, at the time you feel like lower than anything. But it also keeps you coming back when you get so close. And then when you finally get those moments where you win and you're on top of the world and you win a gold medal, and, you know, those are the moments that they make those moments so much sweeter. Because if you go through your career and you just win everything and you never have adversity or, you know, some really tough losses, I find that it would be too easy and you wouldn't appreciate it as much. And looking back on my career, you know, as hard as those moments were and as much as I just wanted to quit and never step back step foot on the ice again, they've made those successes and those victories that much better. And like this year is a perfect example. Like, I played men's curling and we had a very tough year. We didn't win a lot and it was a very painful year. And then I, you know, this mixed doubles, I played in the mixed doubles trials, which is a new Olympic sport. And it's something I've always loved to play. And it sort of brought the joy back in the game for me. I got back to my roots, why I love the sport and why I love to just compete as an athlete. You know, we ended up winning those Olympic, or, you know, the mixed doubles trials to go to South Korea, and it made that victory that much sweeter. You know, I'll never forget the, you know, the highs and lows of my career.
Now, give us a little insight as, like, are people able to make a living curling, or does this always have to be kind of, you know, a side passion? Like, I know we'll get into it in a minute, but I know you, like, you do a lot of other things. I mean, we even called you the firehouse and things like that. But are people able to just survive off curling, or do you basically have to kind of do two jobs to do this?
Well, I'm a fireman, and how it works is it depends where you're from. Because for the rest of the world, you know, Europe and Asia specifically, there'll be one or two top teams in that country,
right.
And the sport governing body will fund those teams full time. So you're committed to 4 years, but most likely that's an 8 or 12 year program, and you're getting, I don't know what exactly they're getting paid, but roughly, you know, roughly around $100,000, I would say, between $50,000 and $100,000. So, you know, an honest living, and they pay for all your expenses. And, you know, that's how it goes in other countries. As far as it goes, in Canada and a little bit more like this U.S., is there, there's too many good teams in Canada, and you know, we get funded, but it's minimal. So as a result, a lot of us have to have, there's two things we have to do. We either have to go and recruit really good sponsorship that allows us to compete and put everything we got into our sport. But for the majority of us, we have to have their other jobs. So, you know, a lot of guys will have their own business. They'll be golf pros in the summer. I'm on shift work, so I'm able to sort of pick and choose my shifts at the fire hall. And, you know, and we sort of balance our life with, like, you know, why firefighting works so well with me is because I can train at work. I'll do some dry land training at work. And, you know, I don't feel like I miss a beat when I'm at work, right? So we have to get creative here in Canada. And we also have to stay on top because you get monetary, the top, I'd say, five teams in the world will make enough to, you know, to put, you know, food on the plate, on the table for their family. But, you know, if you're only top 20, anywhere that's outside the top 10, it's really hard to make ends meet. And you're just, you know, like, I remember early in my career, honest to God, when I was 20 years old, we would go to these events, stay four to a hotel room, get a couple cots, we'd bring canned food with us, and we would battle. We would just, you know, we'd save every buck we could muster just because it was that tough to make it on tour. And it was a few years of that, of really grinding out, playing on tour, that finally it started, we started getting a bit of sponsorship, and then it gave us a bit of breathing room. But, you know, that's how competitive it is in our sport.
You're like the Stipe Miocic of curling. He's a firefighter, too, and the heavyweight champion of the world, which is pretty crazy.
But, oh, cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, who in all your times of curling, do you have a specific rival or somebody you love to compete with? And are there other countries out there other than Canada where you're seeing a lot of, like, good curlers coming out of there?
Well, you know, I would say the biggest improvement we've seen in the last 3 to 4 years has been out of Asia. You know, they're hosting the Olympics this year and in China and the next Winter Olympics. And they're really putting a lot of time, money, and effort into their program. So they're hiring Canadian coaches for the most part. And they've really developed well. Like, the Korean team this year, I think, will really surprise some people at the Olympics. So, you know, but Europe as well, like, a good friend of mine is from Sweden, and they've competed for the last, I remember playing them in the semifinals of 2010 Olympics. They were just a really young up and coming team. And, you know, they've put a lot of time and effort into this sport. And I hope that they do really well at the Olympics, because I know how much they put into it, and they're really good guys. But also our friends from the U.S., like, nothing would do the sport of curling better than to have the U.S. do something really significant at the Worlds, you know, especially the Olympics. And I know that there's some really good guys on that U.S. men's team. Matt Hamilton, I don't know if you know him. He's just on the Jimmy Fallon show. We'll be playing against him in mixed doubles. We call him the Muzzinator because he's got a muzzy, like a mustache. And he's just a beauty. And he's his character himself is really good for the sport of curling, because he's a great character, a really funny guy, and I think that he'll do the sport of curling, you know, really positive in the States. And we're cheering for, as much as we want to win gold here in Canada, we are cheering hard for our American borders, neighbors from down south, because we know that if you guys can get a medal, it's gonna bode really well for the sport of curling, and we want to see it keep growing in North America and throughout the world, and we wish nothing but the best for you guys down there as well.
Well, fun fact, we haven't won a world championship since 1978, the year John was born. So I blame this guy here. What the hell?
All right. Sorry, guys. Well, I will I'll do my best. Well, I can't say that, you know, if I'm ever there, I'll be throwing a game. But I know that it would be sure nice to see USA at least in a gold medal match, because it'd be really good for the sport. So.
Yeah, and the next world championships is in Vegas.
Nice.
Yeah, look out.
That's cool. Now, outside of curling, you seem to be a little bit of a renaissance man. You're a bow hunter. I read that you went going to chef school. You write a lot about fitness and things like that. So what occupies your time outside of curling, these kind of things? And what got you into the whole, I know you're very big on nutrition and clean eating and stuff like that. So what got you into that? And I also wanted to ask you, the what is the shelf life of a curler? Do you see like is there a certain age where you see a lot of people like they can't do it professionally anymore or Olympic level anymore? And the fitness level of these guys.
Well, I'll start with your first question there about you know, I'm a big believer in following your passion, and I think that life is too short to do things that you don't enjoy doing.
Yep.
Just for the sake of making money. So I love curling, and I've stuck with it, and I've absolutely enjoyed every moment of it. I love firefighting. I think it's a phenomenal job and one of the best jobs out there, and I've stuck with that as well. And I also love the outdoors, and I'm very lucky to live in a place right near the Rocky Mountains. I actually, I have where I live now is actually right in the Rocky Mountains, and I love to fish, fly fish, and to hunt. And I bow hunt. I find it's the truest form of hunting. And
yep.
And it also, I like to know what I'm putting in my body. And mm-hmm. and I hunt for meat. I don't just hunt for sport. I hunt because I love the taste of moose and elk. I know how good it is for you. And for me, life gets pretty crazy sometimes when you're in the city and you got a lot going on. And when I go hunting, it really takes my mind and just back to, it just helps free my mind up and it clears my mind a bit too. So that's why I love, doing that and then taking advantage of the great outdoors that we have here in Canada. And with regards to cooking and chef school, I've always, I always want to make sure better myself in the sport and make sure I'm performing at my maximum. And one guy I always look up to is Tom Brady. I know he's a player been one of the best of all time in football. And but he doesn't just, come to work every day and decide to turn it on. Everything he does in life is based, he wants to play football as good as he can for as long as he can. And so he fuels his body well. He trains properly. And
he seems to be doing all right with that whole football thing.
Yeah. I'm a big Eagles fan. I'm actually really looking forward to the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
I know we're in tough, but just watching these last weekend's games where I was on cloud nine there. But, that's why I got into nutrition and what I'm knowing exactly what I put in my body to fuel myself to my best. And here's a cool stat. I went to we don't have a lot of schools, chef schools in Canada that focus on a lot of nutrition. So I looked it up, and one of the best ones in the world is called the Natural Gourmet Institute, and it's out of New York City. And that's I applied. I got in. It was during my 6 months during my off season a few summers ago, and I'd never been to New York City. And I went there and I took this course, and I had one of the best summers of my life. I learned so much, met so many great people, learned how to cook really well, and learned how to cook food that I really like, cooking with, and met some great people down south there. So that sort of got me, more into cooking, and eventually post curling, I'll probably put nutrition and curling or nutrition and cooking together into my next career. And and then just going on to your second question there, guys, as far as I forget. What
the shelf again? Like the shelf life of a curler, like when does it start? What's the average age? Do we see old curlers? Do we see is there an age where like usually you can't do it anymore?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, and it's changed. Back 20, 30 years ago, the shelf life was a little bit longer. The expiry date was more into your, 30s and 40s for sure.
Mm-hmm.
As far as, Kevin Martin, Glenn Howard, they're two of the legends of our sport. They curled it right into their late 40s at the top of the game. So, now that the age of curling, the average age of curling at the competitive level is lowered out, I'd say almost 10 years. Just because of how athletic it's become and how good you have to be a competitive curler now. So, but it also depends what position you're playing.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a front end player, it takes a bit more of a toll on your body. So I would say a front end player, your shelf life is I would say late 30s to early 40s. And I think as a back end player, you can play into your mid 40s still. And okay. Right now I'm 39, and I'm not sure how many more Olympic runs I have left in me. If you treat your body right, and if you train properly and make it a priority to stay fit and to prepare, then I think that you can curl at the top of your game into your mid 40s for sure.
Now, you were named ET Canada as one of the most eligible bachelors out there. Is it hard to find a woman in curling? What's going on here?
You know what? That's from a long time ago. It's from 2010.
Oh, okay.
But but here's the thing. I you know, curling. I've curled for many years, and it's been very difficult to you know, you're away a lot, right? So it's hard to. One of the biggest challenges we have when you're playing on tour is to hold down a family life, because it's tough on you. It's tough on your spouse and your partner. And however, I met a great gal when I was in New York City. And I met a really good, really great woman from the U.S. And we've been dating for the last 2 years. She recently moved to Canada, and we've been living together for about the past year. And she's the one. She's a fantastic woman, and I feel very grateful to have met her. And I owe it all to my southern neighbors, because I didn't go down to that chef school. I would never have found her. So. Feel like a pretty lucky guy, and I got to thank you guys for that.
you think if you dated like a woman in curling, their house is just really clean, like swept?
Well, I'll tell you why I couldn't date a curler is because I love balance in my life, and I love to, you know, the last thing I want to do when I'm home is talking about curling. And you know, when you're dating a curler, it's a lot of curling surrounding you. So when I come home, Maggie doesn't even know about, she never even knew about curling when I started dating her, and it was awesome. I can talk about cooking, I can talk about music.
I agree.
Things that I love to talk about and don't have to bring up why we lost that last game. So,
John,
a nice change.
Before you go, I was wondering when you were talking about the bow hunting and the clean eating and stuff like that. I don't hunt, but I listen to a lot of Rogan, and I hear guys like Cameron Haynes and Remy Warren, all these guys, Adam Greentree, all these guys getting like the awareness out for hunting and eating. And I find it very inspirational. I also find like you, a guy who is doing other things, very inspirational. It goes in with all that whole group of guys are doing, you know, I think Rogan is a great, I don't know if you listen, but he's a great example of doing a million different things and following different passions. So I was going to ask you before you go, where do you see yourself once this curling thing ends? I know you said something about nutrition, but where do you see yourself maybe 10 years from now when maybe you're not competing full time?
Well, I'd still like to be involved in the sport, you know, whether that's at a coaching level or being part of, you know, helping out with or developing some programs here in Canada.
Right.
Who knows? I'd still like to have, you know, a piece of curling in my life, because it's been, I'd like to give back a little bit, I guess. And but for the most part, like I've, you know, I have a lot of different, I guess, goals going forward. And it's hard to be stepping in with 2 feet, you know, right now, because I'm trying to win, you know, another goal for my country, and that's taken up a lot of our time. But, you know, I'll still be hunting and fishing a lot. Like I fish on the coast. And I, you know, I fish for salmon and halibut, and I fill my freezer with that every year. I'll always be doing that. You know, I'll never be in an old age home. And you know, when I'm older, I'll be in a cabin in the woods, and until, you know, I can't even move, because that's just the way, you know, I'm wired, and that's the way I see myself when I'm older. But one thing I really want to do up here is be part of a food movement up in Canada. Right now, we you know, in Alberta at least, we don't have a lot of produce that we can get year round. And you know, going back to that being self-sustainable, and you know, I always want to you know, create a better quality of life for my family and for the people around me and for you know, my community. And one way to do that, I think, is to provide better access to good food. And I think that one thing that we don't have up here right now is good food that we have access to 365 days a year.
Right.
And I really want to be part of the movement that allows, you know, we can't grow food just because we get so cold up here for the months of, let's say, December to March and April. So right now I'm actually looking into a few different options, exploring some options as far as ways to sustain produce and, you know, 365 days a year, so that we can eat good local seasonal produce that we can get not only during the summer months, but during the winter months, you know, using things like, you know, solar power and geothermal heat and things like that. That's something that really really resonates with me, that I could see myself getting into, and also combining that with my nutrition and my chef background, and really making all of that work together. So I can't wait to see what the next chapter brings. You know, it's hard to put too much energy into that right away, but the wheels are in motion, and I can't wait to see, you know, what the future brings. So
that's awesome, man. So I guess if people want to say hi to you or follow you with what's going on, or I know you wrote a book, where can they go?
Well, I have a book. It's already sold out. We're going to be released an ebook version, so that's called Fit to Curl. And I guess the best way to reach out is you can follow me on Instagram. So my Instagram is JohnnyMo_7. And I like to post things all about curling, but for the most part about just things I love to do in my life and people that are important to me. And then also on Twitter, I'm JohnnyMoCurler on Twitter. So those are the two best ways to get a hold of me. And I like following cool people on that as well. And I'm going to have to start following your show because didn't know about you guys up here in Canada until my friend Dean Gemmel told me about it. So I'm going to have to start following and listen to some more of your episodes, fellas.
Yeah, we've interviewed a couple of hockey players.
Oh, yeah.
Jim Poplinski from the Calgary Flames. Yep, Dave Anderchuk.
So yeah, we've had a couple Canadians on here too.
There was a
1 month where we did like four Canadians in a row, and my phone bill was like through the roof.
Yeah, we had the couple who made their homemade island in Canada,
in British Columbia over there. Yep. Mm-hmm. But we wish you the best of luck, man. Come home with a gold medal. All right.
Well, thanks a lot, guys. Thanks a lot for having me on the show and introducing curling to a lot of listeners that maybe haven't heard it before. I appreciate your support in the game.
Thanks so much, man. All right. What a good episode tonight.
Definitely. Very athletic episode.
Athletic. Mm-hmm. Just like us.
Mm-hmm. Half of us.
But, you know, like, it's just really cool to hear different people. I always love to hear what athletes do. And, like, I was talking with Kenny Anderson, like, when it's done, like, when it's over, mm-hmm. like... And you could tell, like, a lot of people are just probably trying to force you into coaching or commentating or something.
Yeah.
It's like, all right, I did this for my whole life. Like, I don't want to spend my whole life doing it, you know? Like,
well, at least he kind of knew his goal wasn't in sports. Like, a lot of them get out. It's like, oh, my God, what the hell do I do? This is all I've been doing for some of them, like, pretty much their entire life.
Oh, yeah, especially nowadays. It's like they start recognizing these guys at, like, 9 years old, mm-hmm. you know? Like, but... two really fascinating interviews. Hopefully we'll have another, well, I guess we already have, but a new Olympic champion to add to our resume.
Yeah.
But he's won two already, so. But
look,
maybe a gold would be awesome. But yeah. So we'll be rooting for.
I think the only thing we're waiting on is an NBA champion. No offense to Kenny. But
you heard that, Kenny?
You let us down, Kenny. It was a wonderful interview, and we loved you, but God damn it!
You know what? I think the odds are a little lower. It makes sense with the NBA because there's only like 12 guys on the team. So the the pool of numbers is much different than like baseball, football.
That is true. But I mean, if you.
We'll
I mean,
one.
Since if you go back to like some of are like still in the, like if you go to like the late 80s or something like that, you're bound to catch
We're
somebody.
We're gonna get one. So, for those of you who might be the first time listening, we've had, as far as baseball, we've had Lenny Dykstra and Mo Vaughn on the cast. We've, Mo didn't win the championship, but Lenny Dykstra did.
Mm-hmm.
We had Dave Anderchuk and Jim Poplinski on. Mm-hmm. In NASCAR, we had Trevor Bayh,
Daytona 500 winner.
And then we had Takuma Sato. He was at trivia. The other day I was playing this trivia game on my phone, and that was the answer. It was like first Asian guy to ever win the Indy 500. I'm like, no way.
Is there a way to comment my answer? Here is the link.
Here's the link. So we've had that. MLB.
Trent Dilfer.
Super Bowl champion. So we've had a lot of nope. We're getting on to not to toot our own horn, but let's toot.
And Marcel Balboa, who was in the World Cup.
Yep. So we've had a lot on, but I think it's that time, Barlow, to get the hell out of here. Anything to promote?
I will promote our friend since it's the Raw 25th anniversary show tonight. The Shining Wizards podcast, ladies and gentlemen. Our friend
Raw 25th. Oh.
You're like the one comedian who's just
I know,
like,
which is weird.
But like you're the one that actually doesn't have plans come like WrestleMania time frame. And why is there no shows tonight?
But yeah, go check out the Shining Wizards podcast.
Kevin Garifro, good friend of ours. You can check them out. They have a website, shiningwizards.com. They have a lot of great people from the wrestling industry. Brother Love has been on there. Disco Inferno, Vader.
Chris Jericho.
The list goes on and on.
They're a good podcast. Very organized and committed, and they've been around for a while too.
So unlike us,
definitely. Hey, no, we are great. So I'm going to promote Dean Gemmell's podcast called The Curling Show.
Yeah,
he is the reason we were able to get Johnny on today, and it's called The Curling Show. The podcast that brings you interviews with the sport's top athletes and the people who shape the game. It looks like his last episode came up on January 5th. Dean is a very funny comedian, too. So go check out Dean and his cast and maybe watch some curling come February 8th. And, you know.
You realize if you presented to somebody, you probably could convince like a kid like curling's like the new fresh thing, you know. It's like butt chugging. No, seriously.
Curling's the new butt chugging. Name of this episode. But guys, with that, let's get the hell out of here. Life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back. Keep sharing. Keep subscribing. Listening. Go back into our catalog. That's where what we're proud of. So
comment to us. Let us know what you're like, what you don't like, who'd you like to see. We'll try to make it happen.
Absolutely. All right. Adios. Let's go. Johnny, win some gold medals, and Kenny, send us some cigars.
Yeah.
Adios.
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball.